This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and thank you very much for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen, he's Ewan McElriff. And this week we're going to be concentrating on an issue which is possibly pushing the point to call it a national emergency, but certainly it's a national phenomenon and it's getting a lot of people agitated, and we thought we should really talk about it.
Yeah, it's so-called wild camping, but it's not really wild camping at all.
Now, as we discovered on our live programme for BBC Radio Scotland, Out of Doors, this was something that's getting a lot of people agitated, a lot of people very upset about it. But more relevantly, having established there was a problem, we actually managed to find, we think, some solutions in amongst this. So this is what we came up with.
You're listening to Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and a very good day to you. What a splash of rain there was last night. Really lovely day yesterday afternoon here in the northeast of Scotland. It was warm but windy. The wind died overnight, but it just teemed down with rain. But this morning, blue skies and the swifts up there, scimitar-winged, beautiful wee things. I'm Mark Stephen. With me this morning, 40 miles to the north, Mr. Ewan McElriff.
Also in glorious sunshine this morning. The wind has gone, the sun's up, and it's just that low angle on the barley. It's like a golden searchlight. Mm. It's just a wonderful day to be in Scotland. Not quite the heat wave as you said yesterday, but we're hopeful. We're always keen to hear from you. You can email us at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk.
Yeah, folk are getting, I think, understandably agitated about this because a new phrase has come into our vocabulary: dirty camping. Now, dirty camping means different things to different people, but the signs are pretty obvious. The littering, vandalism, destruction of property, trees being chopped down or broken, folks setting fires in an irresponsible way, unhygienic toileting, entire campsites being abandoned and left for somebody else, and I'm not sure who, to clear up. And sadly, this seems to be happening in lots of areas of Scotland. This, it's not new, but the sheer scale of it is. In many tourist hotspots, the facilities aren't back and running. So what's the solution? We're going to try and find out today what can be done to improve the infrastructure to cope with this new influx of tourists. We'll hear from home and abroad and from the man in charge of rural economy and tourism for the Scottish Government, Fergus Ewing.
Slight diversion at the moment. We've got our mystery bird that's still going to make an appearance, and it's got a variety of sounds to its name. So we're going to start off with one I think that's pretty hard. Here it comes. If you've got any ideas on that, have a go. You know, it's pretty challenging. I wouldn't have got it. Nope. Email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk.
When that sound came on for a start, I thought to myself, surely we are not asking our listeners to try and identify a bird by the sound of its wing beats. But no, there was a sound after that.
There's a whole new dimension there.
Next week, we'll give that a go, see what happens next week. We stuck up a comment midweek on the Out of Doors Facebook page about the amount of camping that's been going on in Scotland. Now, the vast majority of camping going on in Scotland has been fantastic. I mean, folk have been very well behaved and doing it properly, but there's a small but very significant minority who have not been doing it. And the amount of comments that came in on our Facebook page has just been astonishing. Here's just a few of them. Fiona McPhail says, I bought a small camper van with a loo, but I'm so disgusted by dirty camping, I feel I don't want to go anywhere until autumn.
And Brian McAllister says, it seems like some local authorities, urgently need to rack up toilet and waste disposal facilities. It's not good enough to sit back and blame the public when the facilities aren't there or they're closed. It seems to me like a tourist industry and the infrastructure is somewhat dependent on the public taking foreign holidays so that they can cope.
Well, there's an element of truth in that. Donald MacDonald, yeah. Who I met before, and I think in 2012, he gave me a lift in a cargo bike near Bishop Briggs, says, I run the online group Campaign for Real Ayres. That's A-I-R-E-S. We are 6,000 people and their families who want to relax on holiday, knowing they are not upsetting local residents and that they have someone to park overnight as they visit restaurants and shops. Ayre is the French name for a dedicated motorhome parking area, either with or without facilities to get fresh water and dispose of toilet waste. If waste facilities are not available on site, they will be available close by at a location where providing them is technically easier. A common thread amongst camper members is their disgust at so-called dirty camping. Motorhomes have space to carry away litter, onboard toilets, and no desire to leave our accommodation behind as litter the next morning. It's important to find solutions as staycationing could be here for a long time. And that's Donald MacDonald.
Yeah, absolutely right there. Another person who got in touch via Facebook and joined us in a minute or two is Anne Widdop of the Stop Trashing Malig, Morar and Arisaig Facebook group.
Yeah, since lockdown has been slowly lifting, all of these three areas have seen a marked increase in campers eager to get out in nature and soak up the views. And you can well understand that. Their presence, however, hasn't been without some tension. As Ewan says, Anne joins us now. Good morning, Anne. How are you?
Good morning. I'm pleased to be with you.
Yeah, and very nice to have you too. Just how busy has it been in your area?
Since lockdown got lifted, the weekend started on the 11th and 12th of July, before even the 5 mile travel had been lifted. The first weekend we had 42 tents appeared on Morar Beach. It was basically a shanty town of tents, crammed in cheek by jowl. The road was blocked with cars and camper vans, the bins were overflowing, people dumping rubbish in every nook and cranny. Then after the weekend, Mark, you've described it, abandoned tents, camping gear, fire pits, destroying the marram grass and the human excrement everywhere. It's truly awful. It really is the wholesale desecration of an internationally important habitat, and it's happening right across Scotland. The responsible, sensitive visitors are already saying they don't want to visit and they don't want to come back entirely due to this. So it's an awful problem. It's not just about the bins. It's a much bigger problem than that.
So who has to pick up the rubbish and the waste? Or does it just lie there?
Well, the locals are doing it. There's a local group in Arisaig who are going out and cleaning up the beaches. We're all volunteers. People are just going out with bin bags and gloves on and picking up the rubbish. We have got some commitment to get some extra bins put in, but it's not just an issue of the actual rubbish. We're in the middle of a global pandemic. I mean, this is a bit of a double whammy for us. We've got COVID-19, so what better way to introduce a deadly virus into a small community than have an unregulated group of people visiting the area? I mean, there's no track and trace for these people that are coming here, that are, I won't even call them wild. They're not wild campers, they're car campers. How can we control that? It's shocking.
I have never heard that phrase before, car campers, but I'm going to use it in future if you don't mind, because I know exactly what you mean by it. I'm very uncomfortable with people calling it wild camping, because it's not. Wild camping, in my experience, is usually highly responsible. You know,
exactly.
And at the end of the day, there's no sign of anybody having been there.
Exactly. And I've started up this campaign and trying to spearhead a group of people to do something about this across Scotland. I've been a wild camper my whole life. I've walked and climbed the mountains of Scotland for, 40 years, 30 years. And it's not wild camping. It's nowhere near wild camping. People want to drive a car to a place and then get out and just camp right next to it. I mean, that weekend in Mora, for example, was 42 tents, so you think about it, there's probably at least 100 people there. Where are they all going to go to the toilet in the morning? Well, it's obvious.
Is there a police presence there at all? Because some of these people are breaking the bylaws and the laws.
Well, I think that's a really important question, Ewan, because there's one cop that manages the area from Malling down to Fort William.
Knocking on 40 miles.
Yeah. And he actually has got a bigger area than that. So there's maybe one or two of them on, and that's it. And the other ruse that people have, and this has been promoted on these Facebook pages for supposed wild campers, is if the cops come and challenge you, just tell them you've had a drink and they can't move you on. And our local policeman, who we've been working with, has said that's exactly what they're doing. They just crack open a bottle of beer.
Well, what do you think the solution to this is?
Well, I think there's two issues here. I think there's an immediate issue, which is to do with COVID-19. And I think there needs to be, like the Scottish Government can do this, an immediate ban on roadside camping to stop people doing exactly what I've been describing. I think in terms of there's a bigger issue, a more of an infrastructure issue, and it's about over-tourism in Scotland. This, and you described it at the beginning of the programme, there's a lack of infrastructure, but there's also an issue just with sheer volume of visitors, and also there's a culture of entitlement with people as well. So they want to go wherever they want, do what they want. So I think there needs to be an immediate, quick fix to this, and. You know, I really hope that Mr. Ewing doesn't just kick this into the long grass and say, we'll commission some research on it. We know the problem. We need action now for this immediate issue. But then the longer-term issue, I think there's something needs to be done to control the camping in some way. Permit schemes, like they've done in New Zealand. It's all doable.
Yeah, Mark and I were in the States, Yosemite, looking at how they, you know, the ranger service, and they absolutely have to have a permit system. You know, some places you have to apply a year in advance. And I was arguing with people last night, there is a finite number of people any country can absorb, and at some point you have to say, okay, Mull's full, Arisaig's full, whatever. Yeah. But we need somebody, I'd like your thoughts on it, do we need a ranger service or the police to have more powers to make that happen?
I think it's a combination. For example, there's a Arisaig Community Trust here. They would be quite willing to take on and employ a warden. If we had some camping areas that permitted a specific number of wild camping areas along the beaches, so you had a finite number, and we generated a small amount of income, it would allow us to employ a ranger or a warden. So, that's a really simple answer to it.
When we were in Yosemite, Anne, you know, basically, not only did you have to get a permit, you had to stand for an hour and get a lecture about how you should comport yourself in the wilderness at the same time. So there was no excuse. It didn't matter what your background was. You know, basically, you were going to be educated standing there for an hour, and you had to be able to parrot it back to them, and you had to stick to it. Because I wonder how much of the problems we're facing at the moment is to do with the fact that people don't know how to do it.
I agree with you. I think there is a small hardcore of people that just don't care, that'll do whatever they want. But I think there are also people who do care but just don't realise the damage they're doing. And they think, if I don't leave a trace, I'm not doing any damage. But actually, they still are. They're camping on the Macher. Mm-hmm. You know, they shouldn't be there. And, you know, the beaches are not there. They're not a campsite. You know, it's a real treasured habitat that we've got here, so... They just shouldn't be there. So I totally agree that some sort of... You could have a free permit scheme for wild campers where you apply for it for free, but you've got to pass some sort of test to say you understand the codes and how to behave. I don't see anything wrong with that. And as a wild camper myself, I wouldn't have a problem with it if it helped to solve this issue.
Anne, it's been... Well, it does not seem lovely speaking to you, because obviously it is alarming, but you know what I mean by it. Thank you very much for your time. We appreciate it.
You can tell I'm really passionate about it. And I nearly wept when I was at the beach on Monday night. I can't go back there at the moment. So yeah. I really appreciate you highlighting it on this programme.
No problem at all.
And anyone that wants to help with our campaign, please get in touch with me.
That was Anne Woodup of Stop Trashing Mallaig, Mora and Arasig there. And as you know, it's one of the most beautiful areas of Scotland, and it does need to be protected.
You can see the attraction of it, camping on the beach in that idyllic location, but, you know, you're destroying the reason that people love it. Anyway, let us know what you think. You can get in touch by email, outofdoors@bbc.co.uk.
After months and months of lockdown, you actually managed to escape this week.
Yeah, I've been filming in Mull for Landward. It felt really strange driving a long way. Kind of got cramp in my right leg in the accelerator after 5 hours. So I'm not quite much fit yet. But while I was there, and this is a different take on it, I thought I would drive around and see if the Mull was suffering of any ill effects that we've been talking about.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome aboard this Caledonian McGrath vessel. Please listen very carefully to the forward safety announcements. In the unlikely event of an emergency, you'll be informed by means of an emergency signal.
I've just caught the ferry from Lochalan to Fishnish. Pretty bumpy crossing, but there wasn't many people on it. It was half full. So I've just driven down to Craignure, where the Isle of Mull has just docked from Oban, and it is a constant stream of traffic. There is camper van after camper van after camper van. Cars with boxes on them, cars laden with bikes. It's got a real holiday island destination feel about it. It's busy, but there doesn't seem to be any problems in the immediate area around Craignure at the moment. But I'm going to travel a bit further north to try and get a feel of what's like here. I was speaking to one of the locals a wee bit earlier this morning, and they said if you go to Carseg Pier, you might find people acting badly there. Well, I've come down, it was about 3 miles of torturous single-track road that ends in a dead end, and it is the most stunning bay ever. Huge, massive cliffs towering above it, and this perfect amphitheatre with a tiny wee pier, and there is one camper van parked under the woods, but nothing else. No camping, no litter again. There's a solitary heron looking at me as I speak. But if you were going to trash a place, this would be the perfect place to do it. It's isolated, it's beautiful, and it's pristine. I've driven down to the southwest, and I'm looking over the small stretch of water that separates Mull from Iona. There's loads of tourists around. But it took me about an hour to drive from Craignure, where the big ferry comes in, through the stunning scenery of the mountains, and I can honestly say I haven't seen one car parked in a lay-by, no camper vans in fields, no wild camping, and no litter at all. So perhaps Mull has escaped the ravages that have plagued other parts of Scotland, but it's early days yet. Well, that's it. I'm giving up. I'm going to be honest, when I came onto the island, I thought it would be like many other places, suffering badly, like Loch Lomond's side. But I've just been up the west coast of Mull, I've crossed over the mountains by the tourist route, and I'm now in Salon. And I've seen no problem parking, no problem wild camping. And I was going to say virtually no litter, I've seen no litter. But whether it's because it's a different type of tourists, whether it's because it's an island, I've no idea, but Mull is just an absolute delight.
Why do you think that is? Why have they not got the problems?
I don't know. I was I was chewing it over. Maybe it's just because it's early in the season and it's not got to plague proportions yet, and there's going to be people in Mull shouting at the radios.
Why are you talking about us? Shut up. Yeah, exactly.
Or, as I touched on there, maybe is it the car campers are maybe a different, attracted to different kind of places. I did see a couple of car campers on the way back from Loch Allen to the ferry at Corran, but that was it. But at the moment, they seemed to have escaped it. But there was a lot of talk. The folk I spoke to Dave Sexton from the RSPB and said, we're looking at what's happening on the mainland with horror and saying, you know, it might come our way. We don't know.
Yeah. Well, we're talking about Dave Sexton, RSPB, Mystery Bird, causing the usual pandemonium this morning. Barry Sutherland, our South Yorkshire ornithological correspondent, has got it wrong. He reckons it's a grouse. As does John. John and Elgin says, grouse. Lillian Forrest says, is it a puffin? Nope. No, it's not. Willie the farmer near Bruchen says, red grouse is the mystery bird. Not really, it's not. Karen in Shetland says, is it a pterodactyl?
Yes.
Yes, yes, absolutely. No, it's not. And she goes on to say, happy Lammas, Karen in Ardrigh, Shetland. And I got a card with a stamp on it this morning from Karen saying, happy Cake Day. This is 1st of August, Lammas, the first of three harvest festivals. The name Lammas comes from the Anglo-Saxon loaf mass, celebrating and giving thanks for the grain harvest. And apparently in Shetland, grain from the first sheaf of corn was harvested, threshed, dried and ground and made into the harvest bannock and used in a ritual meal. Corn is a generic term for any cereal crop in Shetland. This is fascinating stuff. I'm much obliged to you. That's our mystery bird this week.
Too easy now.
Not necessarily.
Well, it's pretty distinctive. I mean, well, anyway, we shall see. If you know what that is, give us a call, 0808 529500.
Now, Mar Huntley, and I'm not sure if that's a name or Mar from Huntley, apparently was in South Island, New Zealand. Wild camping is catered for there. Long drop toilets and a water tap. These are to be found everywhere. And guess what? Not a single rubbish bin in sight. Everyone takes their rubbish home. Not a sweetie wrapper in sight. Scots don't love Scotland, it seems. That's the opinion of Mar. We are addressing the rural tourism issue today and how some areas of the country are suffering badly because of a lack of facilities. Either they just simply don't exist or they're currently not open. We're not going to call it well camping. Car camping and campervan etiquette has also come under fire. So to find out how a country, often compared to Scotland for its scenery, deals with such things, we're going to Wellington in New Zealand now to join Chris Roberts, Chief Executive of Tourist Industry Aotearoa, I'm guessing, an independent association that represents all sectors of New Zealand's tourism industry. Thanks very much for joining us, Chris.
Good morning to you. Good evening from New Zealand.
Good evening to you too, then. How do you actually pronounce that properly?
It's Tourism Industry Aotearoa, with Aotearoa being the Maori name for New Zealand.
Ah, right. My apologies. Okay. We are struggling a bit in Scotland at the moment with more folk making way to tourist hotspots. There's been issues with camping and camper vans, not enough facilities. How does this work with you?
Well, freedom camping's been a huge issue here over the last few years, and actually mostly in a negative way. People have been concerned about a big growth in that form of travel here in New Zealand. Much like Scotland, people come to New Zealand for the landscapes and scenery. It's a self-drive destination largely, so people do like to drive themselves. And we have plenty of places where you can park up for the night and just stay. And with the popularity of tourism growing pre-COVID, the numbers increased and the number of people freedom camping increased, and that started to concern a lot of people because of things like disposing of rubbish and the lack of facilities where people were staying. So it's had a lot of attention, and we've tried to get on top of it, partly by putting in more appropriate facilities. So like your correspondent mentioned just beforehand, some basic toilet facilities, the strong encouragement not to leave rubbish behind, not to leave human waste behind in particular, which really gets people going if they see, essentially if they see poo, human poo left behind.
Yeah.
that's really, you know, that gets a local community up in arms pretty quickly.
So how have you addressed it? Has it been the government that have started putting toilet facilities? And waste disposal is kind of crucial to this. Is this a government initiative, or is it bodies like yourself are demanding some action on it?
Well, it did require some government funding. I'm on something called a Tourism Infrastructure Fund, which has largely funded toilet facilities for these sort of things around the country. So local authorities have wanted to put on some basic facilities for these freedom campers, and essentially that means some hard surfaces to park their camper vans on and an adequate toilet facility. The secret is not giving too good a facility, because you still want to encourage people to go and stay in a holiday park, a caravan park, with a commercial operator if they want a really good quality experience. But we have to recognise some people are wanting to get away from it all, do it on the cheap and not pay for their accommodation. So give them some basic facilities, but don't go over the top.
What actually happens with the, you know, you say people go camping in camper vans, that's fine, but people also go camping in tents and things. When they poo, what are they supposed to do with it?
That's a big part of the debate between self-contained and non-self-contained travellers. So certainly if you're in a tent, you're encouraged very much to stay in a commercial facility or in a much smaller number of these freedom camping sites that will allow for non-self-contained visitors. So that's someone travelling in a car or with a tent, and those places would have significant toilet blocks, showers, etc., and possibly with a charge around those facilities. A lot of the debate is over vans that claim to be self-contained, but may not really be so. So they might have like a port-a-loo stuck under the back seat. We're looking at tightening up those regulations, because those are not really self-contained vehicles. Those people are very unlikely to be using those onboard toilet facilities, and so then you get that whole problem emerging again.
But how do you police that? Does the police do it? Do you have a ranger service? Do you get fines?
What we've managed to do for the last two summers very, very successfully is, with some a little bit of government funding, is to employ ambassadors, camping ambassadors, who just go out to these sites, because what we've found is people don't want to be doing the wrong thing. They don't want to be upsetting the local community. So when you go around to these popular camping sites with a camping ambassador, so this is generally not someone who's looking to fine you, it's not a police officer, it's someone coming around and saying, oh, hang a minute, mate, your vehicle's not allowed to park here, you don't have the right facilities, the place you need to be is 20 kilometres down the road, how about you head there? And of course it's a light touch initially, and if you've got some people who are determined not to obey the rules, then you can impose a fine on them.
And that wouldn't be the ambassador imposing the fine, it would be the police, presumably?
Yeah, so they would usually call in another authority to impose the fine. But, you know, the gentle touch is working on the whole. You know, 95% of the time, people want to do the right thing and they're not looking to offend anyone.
Yeah. Chris, that has been really fascinating. It's an excellent insight, and one that we badly need at the moment. So thank you very much for your time.
And all the best with it. Scotland's a fantastic place to visit, and there's always going to be a different way of travelling around a country like yours. And if you can cater to every style of travel, you'll do very well.
Excellent. I appreciate the advice. Thank you very much. Coming up, what COVID-19 has meant for Scottish hostels, and we meet an adventurer who thinks Patagonia might have some solutions for our very own tourism problems. There was a lot of rain this week, and this is not tent canvas or nylon or whatever it is they actually use nowadays, but I've got some haps up at the back because I'm doing some building outside and the weather's so changeable I need this. But just have a listen to this will be very, very familiar to anyone who has ever camped in Scotland.
I defy anyone not to have a smile on their face listening to that very well-known bird. A lot of you getting it right, but a few who failed so far, but they might get it from that one. Mary Frame says it's a tern. Hugh and Orkney says it's a fulmar. Sandy Main thought it was a great black gull. None of these are right.
We're tackling the issue of rural tourism today, especially in the current situation, because my folk can't go abroad. And the trouble is, There's heaps of people wanting to get out in the countryside, which we can entirely understand, but it's causing some issues. A camping trip in Scotland seems like a fun and affordable option, which it is. Lots of folk, I would say the vast majority, manage to do it without causing any bother at all. But there are a small minority either don't have a clue how to do it properly or just simply don't care.
Loads of you have been getting in touch. One from Helen Monroe. Thank you for a wonderful programme, a regular listener. I live in Black Isle. I used to live in Rosemarkie in the Black Isle, and I've never seen so many people, cars, caravan, campers in the area, even in the height of summer. As an ex-small two-bedroom B&B, I would now not recommend any of my guests to visit the beach, as it's mobbed and goodness knows what folk are using for toilet facilities.
I've got a handful of comments here. Text saying nothing to do with not knowing what to do with the rules of camping. It's sheer ignorance and pure disrespect for the country and the fellow citizens. I'm so very disappointed that I live in a country where my fellow citizens would act like this. I live in a Scottish city and often think it would be lovely to visit around my own country, but not now. I'm heart sorry for the local people who have to live in the countryside with visitors trashing it around them. It's not everywhere. You know, whoever's texted this, it's not everywhere. That it is still isolated incidents. Unfortunately, it's on the increase. Ian Luthermuir says, easy solution to Murray Beach wild camping? Seriously? Allow cattle grazing. Townies are petrified of cows. Again, that's making the assumption that it's all townies. It may not be. Annie Fraser says, I take my hat off to you lot for handling this trashing issue. I live in Perthshire and the mess is a disgrace. Wholeheartedly support Anne and the idea of the Ranger Service. Track and trace is complete failure as far as motorhomes are concerned. Since May, they've had most problems with motorhomes further up north. Definitely getting to be a serious issue. And another text in saying we had the same problems on Eyemouth Beach, men urinating against the sea wall and women behind the rocks. Toilets were open, just 20p to pee. Why can't they take their rubbish home? They brought it full, so will it condense it into a smaller package to take home? All of these comments coming in about this.
An interesting thing on that, Mark, I just think the 20p thing, an awful lot of people don't carry cash anymore.
Yeah.
So is there should it be free? And that would encourage people or some other system, but 20p, I couldn't find a 20p in my car.
Now, I find it, again, I find this extraordinary that they are still charging 20p, to be honest, because, again, yeah, with COVID-19, who wants to handle the change at the end of the day? I wouldn't. Yesterday, we were able to get hold of Fergus Ewing, the Scottish Government's Cabinet Secretary for the Rural Economy and Tourism, to get his views on the situation. I began by asking him, if you accept that COVID-19 has magnified the scale of an existing problem, what is the Scottish Government going to do about it?
It is a problem, and I think you've pitched it exactly right, Mark. It is a small minority of people, and I think we shouldn't lose sight of that. The vast majority of people who go camping and who go in particular wild camping like to leave the environment as they found it. But a small minority behave otherwise. They're breaking the law, they're littering, there's antisocial behaviour, there's pretty foul behaviour. And of course, everyone must respect the countryside and take their litter home. Moreover, littering is a criminal offence. Fixed penalties of £80 can be issued, and if prosecuted, fines are available up to £2,500. And also, Mark, on the spot, fixed penalty notices can be issued for antisocial behaviour such as vandalism, urination, or being drunk and incapable in a public place. So the law does already have remedies. I think that you're right, though, that perhaps the problem has become exacerbated at this particular time, maybe because people have been cooped up in towns and cities, in crowded apartments, flats, and have been desperate to go out and enjoy the beautiful countryside that we have in Scotland. So we have been working with our local government partners, with the police, with national parks, with Forest and Land Scotland, all working to try to to tackle what has been the appalling behaviour of a small minority of those who frankly are spoiling things for everybody else.
But there's been a lot of complaints about chemical toilets being emptied in lay-bys, people leaving human waste around known beauty spots. Surely part of that is due to a lack of the basic facilities. The bulk of the toilets are shut. It's almost inevitable. If you close the toilets and there's nowhere to dispose of waste, it's going to happen.
Well, it's up to us all as individuals to make appropriate arrangements to plan ahead. If you're going on any kind of holiday involving camping or the use of a caravan, and the vast majority of people do. Some years ago, we set up with our local government partners a fund called the Rural Infrastructure Fund, and this was designed to deal with pressure points in the hotspots, if you like, in Scotland, the fairy pools in Skye, and this fund has been very successful. I'm certainly advocating within the Scottish Government that there's much more we can do. For example, I know that in continental Europe, there are far better facilities for camper vans to refuel, to dispose of waste. They're called AIRES, A-I-R-E-S. I do think there's a case for perhaps considering the development of AIRES in appropriate venues in Scotland. I myself live in Badenoch and Strathspey, and Glenmore has been one of the areas where there has been lots of concern expressed. And just a week ago, I went for a walk along the beach in Loch Morlaich and around the loch. And I did find, from my own evidence on that particular day, firstly, that the vast majority of people had plainly tidied up after them. There was very little litter at all. And secondly, as we were leaving at lunchtime, and it was on a Sunday, there were people from the forestry out generally taking an interest in what was going on. And yes, there is a serious problem, and I think there's more to do, to be quite candid with you. And I, as tourism minister, I'm determined that working together with my colleagues in local government, with Rosanna Cunningham, who's responsibility for the Countryside Code, we should really look at all aspects in order to see if there's more that we can do. But at the end of the day, you know, it's up to each individual for their own behaviour. Last autumn, I visited Norway in a business trip, and over 3 days of a visit, I saw two pieces of litter anywhere in Norway. It's plain there's a cultural problem, I'm afraid, in Scotland and Britain that seems to regard littering as acceptable. It is not acceptable, and it's about time that we all kind of accept that, including minority who spoil matters for others, as I've said.
But that requires a kind of a social change, but at the moment, surely we need boots on the ground. We need rangers, countryside rangers, to enact some of these bylaws. And the reality is many, many rangers posts have been lost without Scotland, and many are still on furlough. You need guys in the area. I was saying, stop it. You'll take your litter home with you.
As we all know, Scotland has an enormous countryside. It's not possible to have rangers everywhere. But you're right, they do play a part. They are playing a part. Some are furloughed or have been furloughed, as you have said, and therefore that makes things a little bit more difficult. But at the end of the day, you know, we can't have a ranger per camper. It is really up to the individual. And I do think that part of the answer is just to get the message out, as this programme is doing, that littering and defouling countryside is just not on.
I think getting the message across is part of what Ewan was suggesting. The Rangers are very good at that. They have an ambassadorial role to a certain extent. But, you know, even if we had a multiplicity of Rangers, many, many more Rangers than we currently do, you've still got the problem of enforcement. You reeled off a whole list of laws there that, you know, people can be fined under this law, etc. Fine. But the Rangers can't do that. The police have to do that. The Rangers don't. Do they need more powers?
Well, I think you're right in the sense of the Rangers' ambassadorial role. They don't go in with a heavy stick. They go and speak to people and seek to educate people, bring out the best of people, rather than approach it from an enforcement point of view. And to be fair, that's the approach that the police take in this country as well, and quite rightly so. But I don't necessarily think it's a shortage of legal remedies that's the issue here. I do think it's largely an attitudinal problem, and not one that we can change without changing those attitudes. I think that's the fundamental requirement. In the interim, we do need to provide more facilities, I think, particularly in the hotspot areas. And I think the infrastructure fund is perhaps the route to doing that. And the other point I wanted to get across is that I have set up a tourism task force with around 30 members of expertise of a whole range of in tourism. And this is one of the issues that the task force is considering and will bring forward its recommendations fairly shortly, I hope next month.
Is it not down to the fact that outdoor education has been steadily declining in our secondary schools and our primary schools? And if you're brought up through the school system and you don't know how to behave, then you will have this problem. Do we need to get more outdoor education in the curriculum for excellence?
I'm absolutely in favour of outdoor education and the opportunity for young people to enjoy the outdoors and to get outdoors. And there's lots of opportunities that are provided for many children to do just that. But I do think it's not simply a function of outdoor education that leaving a mess behind you is bad. I think it's just a matter of simple, sensible and good behaviour.
If you'd like to comment on what Fergus was saying there just now, you can email us at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk.
Perhaps a National Ranger Service, maybe run by SNH or whatever. Yeah. And an ambassadorial role, absolutely, but we need an iron fist in that glove for those that aren't doing it. But perhaps the police, part of the job should be just to tour the campsites first thing in the morning and just have a presence.
Could be. My wife and I were down in Stonehaven last Saturday night, which was lovely, you know, and, you know, everybody seemed to be very well behaved. One of the things I noticed there was the waste bins. You know, there are council waste bins, they're there all the time, but because more people are coming out, again, entirely understandable, they need to be emptied more regularly. Or do you go down the New Zealand route of saying, no waste bins, whatever you've got in the way of waste, you have to take it home and dispose of it there? I don't know. We are getting swamped by comments this morning. Ferg McGregor in Milner Thought says, the behaviour of a significant number of people would drive you wild. It's a social malaise. Too many don't give a damn about what they leave behind. The right to roam legislation has something to answer for when there's too little infrastructure to administer or police the issue satisfactorily. Norma says, our area, Harlow Pentlands Hills, has one closed toilet. I don't believe the car campers that are littering would walk all the way to use the facilities. What, this is interesting. She says, one group of campers that left all their rubbish when challenged were under the impression that the council came up to clear the place. However, they did go back and clear up. Mark Dootson says, I fear the current situation with irresponsible campers in the Highlands could be the catalyst to bring in nationally similar camping management legislation to that being operated at Loch Lomond in the Trossachs National Park. He's about to embark on a week-long holiday around the Highlands. I hope you enjoy it, Mark. Steve Coffey in Ully in Gloucestershire says, with all the big events cancelling this summer, there must be an abundance of port loo toilets available for hire. Possibly this could be a short-term answer for local councils that could place portaloos in areas where there's a spike in wild camping to reduce the impact on local residents. Again, I'm not sure what the situation is vis-a-vis COVID-19 on that, Steve. That would be a difficult one. Yeah. Pat in Ayr says, in the 50s and 60s, my family pootled about the north of Scotland in a caravan, booked the wee remote caravan club sites, put up our toilet tent, took rubbish to bins. What is wrong with people today? And this one I'm going to finish with, because I think this is really important. Shona in Glasgow says, my name is Shona. I'm a respiratory doctor in Glasgow and I grew up in Lochgear, Argyll. I've therefore been dealing with a pandemic on a daily basis since March. With regard to people feeling entitled to going whenever they like, people need the countryside for mental and physical well-being in the same way that people in rural areas need ventilators and the city hospital staff who operate them, etc., when they get COVID. We can't say people aren't welcome. We need 1, employment of staff as rangers, 2, facilities, and 3, education at school. She goes on to say we could learn a lot from New Zealand. We need to remember we are one nation. Division and animosity is not helpful. Thank you very much. And that is Shona in Glasgow. A lot to agree with there.
One quick point I was going to make, Mark. I noticed in Brechin, Angus rather, they've removed the bins, certainly on the A90, because if you put bins there, people think somebody's going to sort it. If there's no bin facility, people might be more inclined to take it away. Just a thought.
You would live in hope. One of the areas that many flock to in Scotland is the northwest, because it's got everything. It's got magnificent mountains, sandy beaches, crystal clear waters, and some very impressive caves. Our archive piece this week takes us to the Smoo Caves in Durness. We visited there back in 2017, and our guide was a lovely guy, the late Colin Coventry.
We take a boat across the waterfall chamber, and then we're going to get out of the boat and walk for about another 100 metres further into the cave.
I'm excited.
And Colin's got a little Hiawatha paddle.
On the side.
Yep.
And if you could sit next to this lady here. Eh?
Okay.
Now, it's going to tip badly to one side any second now.
Here, just balance it.
Spread out the weight.
That might be a big job, eh? That's it.
Could you sit a bit more on the side?
Yeah.
It's taking three of us to balance Mark.
Yes. Also, there's one here. Effectively, we're in an inner chamber now, which is flooded, and there's a waterfall coming down to the left of us through one of the holes.
Now, this is the waterfall chamber. Now, on the far side of this chamber, you see a huge crack running up the wall that goes right across below us through a rock bridge up there and then down the other side of the chamber. That's the fault line. First, you'll have rainwater inside a fault line, and rainwater will dissolve limestone. Mild carbonic acid rainwater, really. And do you see this big overhang above us, about 50 foot above us? That's the phreatic line. That's above the phreatic line. That's the original cave. And below the phreatic line, that's from the meltwater after the Ice Age. And all the caves in the Highlands will be the same shape as this, see? The fault line, the first cave, and then a much bigger meltwater section there. Now, this being Scotland, there's got to be a monster somewhere, eh? We've got the piranha here, you know. Vicious they are, vicious.
What is that, isn't
it? Oh, it's trout.
Oh, no, it's boy.
How did the trout get here? Somebody chucked them in.
Well, they would have been here from right after the Ice Age. And once the ice receded, Scotland was still connected to Europe. Eh? You could have walked from here to Denmark 8,000 years ago. So we were still connected by rivers to Europe. So all the fresh water fish in the Highlands, they basically swam here on rivers that connected us with Europe.
You're feeding them. There can't be much natural feed here.
They do very well here. These trout feed off freshwater marine snails, and the bottom here is covered in snails. That's probably why they like a wee bit bread now and again.
So how many times a day do you do this?
Well, a busy day will be about 20, 25 tours or something.
So did you just drift into this by accident?
Right, yeah. I used to work here for the Highland Ranger Service. And in those days, it was a seasonal job. You weren't really sure if you're going to get the job next year or not, so I decided I'd try being self-employed and do tours here. Now, I thought I might do it for a couple of years. That was 32 years ago. So I forgot to leave her. Now you've got to really mind your head here. Yeah, seriously, you've got chert here. It's really sharp rock. You don't want to bump yourself.
Beginning to get narrower. You've got the water running
really
through.
Narrow, yeah.
It's about 5-6 feet across.
Yeah, this is the narrowest bit as well. Let me show you this bit for a wee minute. If you look above us here, you'll see bits of grass and heather stuck in the roof here. That was Hurricane Bertha, 2014, sorry, on 10th of August 2014, and the water level was right up to the roof here.
Wow!
Yeah, we take people in here every day, but there's no doubt about it, this is a seriously dangerous place. We have to be very careful here. Now, this is, in front of us here, there's a thump. Now, there's a lot of water coming up. Eh? Now, this water goes underground 500 metres from here. Now, I know this. I put a dye down a very small sinkhole, 500 metres inland from here. The dye came out the sinkhole here, but it also came out of a small sump in the sea cave 100 metres from here. So the dye testing says there's a kilometre of cave somewhere behind this wall. Now, we've tried diving here, but we had a problem diving here with all the mud from the peat. See, once you stir up all the mud from peat, you've no visibility, and we've never managed to find a way through the sump.
Can I just say, sorry, you have tried diving here?
I first tried to dive this 25 years ago. It was the single most terrifying experience of my life.
You seem like such a sensible person. It's such a stupid thing to do.
Well, I know it does, but having said that, we found a lot of caves in the Highlands by diving these sumps. They're worth having a go.
People talk about going into outer space and things like that, but I mean, effectively, you're going into inner space. This is a form of exploration which is literally under your feet and mostly ignored.
Oh, totally. Yeah, you don't have to go to darkest Africa to find unexplored places. I live pretty much right above us here.
That was the lovely Colin Coventry, who sadly passed away last year. A plaque has been erected in the memory of Colin at the caves, and we have checked. The Smoo Caves are open, but there are no tours currently operating into the inner cave. But Fraser, Colin's successor, will be there to welcome you to the main chamber. It was a great experience, though.
It was wonderful, but the thought of diving through a sump just fills me with absolute terror. Loads of you getting the bird right, and some of you still getting it wrong. We got a call from Fitlochry, said it's obvious, it's a gossip bird. Gossip bird, fantastic. And Kate Stevens said it's a black cock at the Lek. In fact, Kate Stevens said her husband says it's a black cock at the Lek.
As it's not far off.
Yeah.
That's not too bad.
Yeah.
Again, heaps of comments coming in. Fiona Gaelic says, I work in a busy tourist attraction in the northwest. Huge complaints from people desperate for the toilet because very few between Inverness and Gaelic. Councils need to take account and get the public loos open again. John and Lewis and Rothy Norman says, good morning, gents, for your cooler Rothy. Thank goodness it was getting awfully warm in the summit, he says. Car camping, two immediate solutions. One, ban roadside camping with police given powers to impose punitive fines. And two, local authorities to reopen local toilet facilities instead of pamming them off onto local communities. Interesting ideas all. In many parts of rural Scotland, popular hill walkers and climbers, hostels make up a vital part of available accommodation, but at the moment they're having to operate very differently from usual. Joining us now to tell us more is Gregor Barclay. Gregor runs Saddle Mountain Hostel in Invergarry with his wife Helen. They're also members of the Scottish Independent Hostels, a group that represents 86 hostels throughout Scotland. They've just launched a campaign, Support Our Hostels. Thanks very much for joining us, Gregor. First off, just tell me a bit about how your hostel usually operates, Saddle Mountain Hostel usually operates. What's happening at the moment?
Under normal circumstances, the hostel here can take up to 22 people. We've got five bedrooms for 22 people, a mix of private rooms and dormitories, and we've got very generous communal facilities, as most hostels do. There's a large self-catering kitchen, large dining room, large communal lounge, and we've got a dedicated drying room and laundry aimed at the outdoors market. In our own hostel, last year, 60% of our guests came to do outdoor activities, hill walking, long distance walking, cycling, paddling and the like. The way it works is that because there are more beds per room, you pay, compared to a hotel or a B&B, a lower price for your bed, and you're sharing your room possibly with people you don't know if it's a dormitory. Otherwise, if it's a private room, often with people you do know, but they're not from your own family. And in exchange for kind of sharing the bedroom and maybe having slightly less space in that, you've got the use of the very generous facilities, and obviously you're paying a lower price.
But can you do that just now with COVID-19?
At the moment, because of COVID, for very good public health reasons, which we fully endorse, what the Scottish Government is saying is that if you're indoors, you have to keep a 2 metre distance from other people. There are also limits indoors on how many households can meet up, currently three, and there's a recommendation that no more than eight people can meet indoors. And for a hostel, that means that it is impossible for us to allow people to share bedrooms unless they're from the same household. It also makes it very difficult in terms of logistics and cleaning to open any of the communal facilities. But where that's left us is that we can only open four bedrooms out of five. So one other thing to mention, by the way, is that the guidance for hostels is that you have to have an allocated toilet and shower per bedroom. And again, one of the quirks of hostels is that the ratio of toilets and showers to beds isn't exactly the same as you would get in a hotel. We find ourselves now that if there's only one household per room, that hugely reduces the capacity.
You've launched or involved in a Support Our Hostels campaign. Yeah. Tell me a bit about that.
We're doing two things at the moment. First of all, Scottish independent hostels, when it became clear a number of weeks ago that we were going to have some problems this summer, did a detailed survey of our members just to find out what their situation was. And one of the worrying results of that was that when the current financial support, which we've had from the Scottish Government, which has been very generous, and we don't begrudge them that, but when that ends, which is going to be roughly the middle of October, over one third of our members didn't think that they could continue trading beyond 6 months. And that only gets us to the end of March. So on the back of that, we prepared a fairly detailed report explaining our situation and the unique circumstances of hostels. That was submitted to the Scottish Government a couple of weeks ago, and we're lobbying them for recognition that we're in a different situation from other accommodation providers.
Essentially here, Gregor, you still want people to come, but it's going to require more organisation and you will be able to take in less of them. But it's important that people still come.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So I was saying we are lobbying the government in terms of additional financial support, but we are also now launching a marketing drive under the banner Support Our Hostels. And we do have backing in that from Independent Hostels UK, which is a similar organisation to ours, but which covers hostels throughout the UK. And what we're saying is hostels are still open. We're not able to accommodate the same number of people as normal. We don't necessarily have all our facilities open just now, but we want you to come. We need you to come. The general public...
And they are more than welcome. Yes. Gregor, thank you very much for joining us on that. It's a valuable insight into a difficult situation at the moment. Gregor Barclay from Saddle Mountain Hostel in Invergarry. We have been talking this morning about folk fleeing the cities and heading for the Highlands and Islands to spend the holidays. You know, basically, that's the kind of thing we do here on Out of Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland. It is not currently without its problems. Recently, on the Scotland Outdoors podcast, we spoke to a lady who took an incredibly low-impact and slow approach to journeying in the Hebrides.
Yeah, Leonie Charlton rode from Barra to Callanish on Lewis with her friend Shuna on their Highland ponies Ross and Chief, and she's been writing about that journey.
And it's a really beautiful book. It's called Marham, which very effectively transported Helen Needham and myself to the Hebrides, but sadly only in our imaginations. I have a complaint to make, by the way, because I said I really enjoyed your book, but I've managed to go all the way through lockdown so far without getting sort of itchy feet, without thinking, oh, I wish I could actually visit there and what have you. And then you started talking about the Hebrides, and I know them reasonably well. For folk who haven't been there, describe them. What are they like?
Intoxicating, very, very changeable. Every minute of every day is different. The light, I think the light is what most captivates me. There's so much sky and so much horizon and nuance in the light. And there's a lot of air and a lot of salt, and quite often there's a lot of wind, and it's very, very invigorating.
Met that woman out and she said, I've been here for whatever it was, 5-6 days, and I've been shattered by the wind. I knew exactly what she meant by that.
Yeah, that wind. And of course then you've got the marram grass holding it all together.
Because it is, a lot of the coastline is actually made up of shell sand. So, you know, you've got the maca that grows in that. So it's just a riot, a profusion, an unbelievable embarrassment of riches when it comes to wildflowers. It's glorious when it's in season. Barra, the only airport in the UK where the plane actually lands on the beach.
It's so romantic, isn't it? It's so elemental. this plane comes in. The tide goes out, the plane comes in, tiny little plane. And in fact, the whole of the Outer Hebrides, that is, it feels remote, as in you're on the edge of something, and yet you're within a community that is so connected.
There's a lovely passage that we'd love you to read that describes a burial ground at Borv Point on Barra. And for me, this just encapsulates the feeling of what it's like being in a place like that so exquisitely.
We'd got to Barra, the beginning of our trip. We'd had our first night of camping. We'd barely slept. It was so cold. We set off down a track to this graveyard. We got off and led the ponies to a gate on the far side of the burial ground. A sign told us it was a Commonwealth graveyard, that casualties from both the First and Second World Wars were buried here. We took it in turns to hold the ponies while the other wandered amongst the stones, listening, touching, reading, the lettered, dated summations of lives, short-lived and long-lived, were being taken over by lichens, some like smooth spillages of cream, others sage green and wiry. The air was strung with the oscillating calls of curlews, and lapwings flung themselves in somersaults against the wind. This place of remembrance was a sanctuary for birds. I felt a sense of privilege to be there that was almost too much to bear. We walked in silence towards the tip of the point, the carved gravestones replaced by body-sized rocks left by the sea or glaciers, or maybe both. A curlew whistled an alarm and we stopped. The sky was full of birds watching over their nests. We had a sense of trespassing on hallowed ground. The bird calls escalated, echoing our own sense of wonder. As we retreated, a slender head and neck peered at us from above a rock. There was something strangely adolescent about this bird as it wheeled up, all awkward elegance before the sky stole it. Later, the bird book told us it was a godwit.
From Barra to South Uist, you took a ferry to Eriski. Now, that in itself has got its own breed of ponies. And it's an island that was once famous for its horses. And one particular character, the silent weaver, Angus McPhee. Tell me about him.
So, Shuna introduced me to Angus McPhee through Roger Hutchinson's beautiful book, The Silent Weaver. He set off to the Second World War in 1939 with his fine gelding. And there's a beautiful picture of him in the book. He went from Uist to the unimaginable horrors, and he came back damaged. And he spent 50 years at Craigdonane Psychiatric Hospital up in Inverness, and eventually in his 80s came back to Uist. He spent the rest of his life making things, weaving things out of flowers and leaves and grass. He made shoes and bags and bridles and halters and nose bags for ponies. That picture of these upstanding young men riding down South Uist on their beautifully turned out horses onto the boat at Loch Boisdell, taking the best away with them.
And one of the things you said there too, that, you know, he would make horse bridles. That's what they did on Eriski.
They were in the army with these marram grass bridles. We'd hoped to have marram grass bridles for that trip, but that's something to do. We'll go back and we'll go in our marram grass bridles, yeah.
The lovely Leonie Charlton there. And if you'd like to hear more about her journey on horseback up the Hebrides, you can have a listen to the Scotland Outdoors podcast we recorded with her. You can find that in the podcast section of the Outdoors page of the BBC Radio Scotland website. Her book, Marram, is out now. It's published by Sandstone Press. And I also have to say that the lovely music there was by Donald Shaw. It's from Islands on the Edge. And I am required to tell you that information because of a point that was made by our friends in Asturias in Spain saying, why do you never talk about the music? Well, we've just talked about the music there. Don't say we don't listen. Steve in Easter Ross says, as a responsible camper van driver living in the Highlands, due to current unpopularity of motorhomes here, now I stay at home. This is interesting, Ewan. Fiona in Moffat says, it costs you to get to Mull. That's why there's less of a problem there. Charge for permits to all the scenic areas like they do in Banff National Park in Canada. Keith says, great programmes again, guys. Very important issues being covered. Very aware, though, that we're preaching to the converted here. Adverts on TV and social media would surely help to teach the unenlightened how to keep enjoying our own country, but sustainably. Remember they used to have that advert years ago about how to use passing places on a single-track road? Bill Patterson and Ali Bain sitting in the back of an open-top car, as I recall.
Playing bluegrass music.
You betcha. Now, as I was saying, could a tourist tax be successful in helping protect areas of natural beauty if the idea were implemented in Scotland? This is one idea that adventurer and kayak instructor Will Copestake personally has seen positively transform Chile's popular holiday hotspot, Torres del Paine, where he teaches each winter. Will joins us now, not from Chile, but much closer to home in Ullapool. Hello, Will.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
No, no problem at all. Delighted to have you too. What's it like in Ullapool at the moment in terms of tourists?
It's good, actually. It's busier than normal, but to be expected given the lift of lockdown. I think everyone is quite rightly coming up here to enjoy the wonderful mountains and sea. I'm currently sitting on a bench enjoying it with a cup of tea.
Have you witnessed much in the way of antisocial behaviour?
Yes, certainly has been. I think it's up a little bit this year than it has been the last few years. I think it's a numbers game. The antisocial behaviour is thankfully the very small minority. The vast majority of people are coming through visiting very positively, and it's lovely to see everyone visiting the area. But those small minority are making an impact in the local lay-bys and car parks. Again, it's a numbers game. If you've got a large group of people, you are going to eventually get one or two who leave litter, waste in those car parks. And that is going to build up over time if there's no facilities to provide for that.
Obviously, we're talking about the impact of rural tourism in Scotland today, but you witnessed a similar situation in Patagonia a couple of years back.
Yeah, so I've been fortunate since 2014. Every other winter, I've been down in Patagonia working as a kayaking guide. I have been lucky to go through the progression that we're seeing here in the north of Scotland. The first year that I went down there, tourism was popular, but just beginning to take off. The area had been made the 8th natural wonder of the world, and a large tourist drive was really encouraging people to visit. Now, those years that came on, the numbers increased exponentially, almost doubling over the next 3 years, without any addition to infrastructure. What happened was you got pinch points, mainly at the campsites. Torres del Paine is very famous for trekking. And at those campsites, the lack of facilities and enormous extra number of people would result in the toilets overflowing into the rivers. There was a waste issue. I even saw a couple of fist fights for people trying to get tent spaces. And it was around about then that the government sat down and went, right, we need to manage this. The government being CONAF, the National Park Authority there. What was interesting to see was that they broke it into a system called flows, frictions and rhythms, managing the flow of where visitors go, the frictions that they develop, and the rhythm that happens, there being seasonally and the rhythm for them being in the evenings where people are looking for camp spots. What was interesting as they developed that and tried to manage it was there was initially a very big local outcry. As people saw it as an invasion of their freedom to be able to go and do what they want. I suspect if you did similar in Scotland and limited freedom of access, you will get a big outcry, and quite rightly. But after a couple of years, people saw the positive impact of that, and they saw the waste management working, they saw the management of movement putting a real positive effect into the national park. And now it's working a lot smoother than it was in 2014.
Do you think this would actually work in Scotland, Will?
I don't know. I think I would like to think it would. I don't know how we would manage it, but I think certainly the best step would be to provide further ranger services and better facilities. What Scotland lacks at the moment is cheap parking. So we've got good campsites, and we've got wild camping or roadside camping. But there's no in-between to cater, like the areas that you have in Europe.
if that's implemented, I think that would manage that flows and frictions fairly well. But it's a longer-term solution.
And it has. Well, the trouble is we need solutions now. We need something. We need a fix kind of starting midweek.
Yeah, so that's where, at the moment, it's causing tensions. The development of community stewardship is becoming sort of a higher tension here anyway. And I think it's trying to get people to sort of self-police themselves, encouraging that mutual education that, not just between locals versus visitors, but between visitors and visitors, to sort of say, hey, this is, we're a community visiting, we need to look after ourselves as a community as well as the locals.
Will, thank you very much for that insight. That's the, again, that's just, it's another perspective and it's really useful. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
No problem at all.
Time for the mystery bird at last. Thousands of you, I don't know, thousands. An awful lot of people. Poor old Lewis could only answer so many phone lines. If you're trying, be patient, but thanks for getting in touch. A lot got right from the start, a lot got wrong from the start. Wait no more.
Colin and Mary Abercrombie say it's an eider duck, which is correct. They also got correct answers from Doug in Olness, Ruth in Inverurie, Barry Thruck thinks it was you impersonating an eider duck, Doogie in Glenrothes, Charlie and Ella Mull, Jake in Bucky, Mandy in Meagle, Linda from Carnoustie, Keith in Blairgowrie, David in Edinburgh, Robin Crail, Morrigan in Inverness. Listen, there's a whole list here and I can't get through all of them, so my apologies. There was lots and lots of right answers, and this is it.
It's an early morning on a remote beach in Iceland. The warmth of the summer slowly ebbs as July gently slips towards autumn. The local pastor was up at dawn to head for the beach. As part of his living, he farms. But today is the day he collects one of the most valuable crops on his land, a commodity that will leave the island and grace the beds of the most rich and famous across the globe. The beach is deserted now, but it wasn't always so. For the last month, the flat land on the edge of the sand was a mass of birds and chicks and predators from the land and the air. He spots what he's looking for and picks up the nest vacated by the ducks which breed here. It looks like the contents of a vacuum cleaner, fluff, sticks and seaweed, and a smell you wouldn't want to take into your home. But that is exactly what's going to happen, because today the pastor is collecting down, eider down, destined for the duvets of those who can afford the finest bedding in the world. The Vikings filled their bedding with it. Medieval tax collectors used it as a form of currency. Eider down is special stuff, and all thanks to the eider duck's habit of plucking feathers from its breast to line her nest. And the down is perfect. Unlike feathers with a solid shaft with branches coming off, eiderdown is a mass of small interlocking threads which clump together to form air pockets to trap warmth. Once the ducks have reared the chicks and headed back to sea, the pastor collects the discarded nests and the process of eiderdown duvets and quilts begin. It's a relationship with man which has existed for centuries. The ducks nest close to habitation. The islanders collect the old nests and in turn protect the eider from foxes, gulls and mink and provide them with fresh water. The eider duck, or the dunter as it's known in Orkney and Shetland, is our heaviest duck and the fastest flying. It can dive to 65 feet to catch mussels, crab and starfish. And the male is unmistakable with its black and white plumage and a green patch at the back of the neck. And the display call is a strange, almost human-like. It spends most of its life at sea, braving the gales and massive waves, and in some cultures they provide an inspiration for perseverance. When a massive wave rolls in, the dunter looks it square in the eye and dives through it to pop up on the other side. Live life like an eider, tackle the problems face on, and you will emerge on the other side. According to folklore, in a big storm, or times of extreme cold, the ducks will huddle together in huge rafts, with birds from the centre occasionally moving out to the edge to swim round the flock to prevent ice from forming. They also have creches with ants, related females looking after large groups of youngsters while the parents forage for food. In the northeast of England, they're known as Cuddy ducks, after St Cuthbert gave them special protection from his base in the Farne Islands. They thrived and nested all over the island, including on the altar. He banned the eating of cuddies, and there are records that claim some monks died of the curse after they ate a protected cuddy. I've said that in the north they're known as dunters, but where did the word come from? Well, for that, you have to go way back. It was a topic the Reverend Swainston tackled in 1887, and he said it came from the ancient Norse or Swedish, where the bird was known as the duntera, dun meaning down, and terra meaning to tear from the breast. Duntera, dunter. And finally, the quilt filled with down is known the world over as an eiderdown. But we call it a quilt. Why? Where does that come from? Well, in Irish Gaelic, the eider is known as a quilt. Keep warm.
The eider duck, and a sound that never fails to make me smile. Some lovely information there. Well done,
Gavin Max. Yeah, Gavin Maxwell actually went to Iceland with a view to setting up an eiderdown industry in Lewis and Harris.
Interesting stuff. Now, we've been talking a lot about camping on this programme today. We've been talking about wild camping, car camping, freedom camping, dirty camping. I am indebted to our senior producer, Helen Needham, my muse for this particular week, to come up with another variation. Clatty campers. Just the term, clatty campers, inspired me to come up with this, yet another Doric poem. I'm nae a lad that scumfishes. I've seen my share of clort. I dinna mind the daily bind, I'm nae the sit-saft sort. My life hasna been connacht with petty fours and shampers. No, the only sort puts me aff my stort is a wheen o' clatty campers. I firm 300 acres in a corner of the How. The land is kind of bosied where the river starts to bow. There's trees and little birdies and wild flowers by and by. It's a bonny kind of corner from the sun's high in the sky. We'd had 4 months of lockdown from the showed up in the park. Tents, twa, then three. Oot on the spree, toonsers on a lark. Loons and quines thegither. An half a wheen of drinkers. A hellish crew from they got full. A mocket mob of minkers. I didn't like their music. Yon rap is awfully violent. I must confess, if I had to guess, the sea in rap is silent. They screamed and roared in the darkness, the din was hard to thole, and whatever they were smoking, it wasnae bogey roll. They'd brocht those tin tray barbecues and even lit a fire. They'd nae brocht ony firewood, but they'd been to chainsaw hire. A richt wee bonny corner scene was looking like a cope. It's whatever they used in Finnish we just landed at their dope, and that wasn't the worst out. They were shiting in the lang grass. An aura sought a caper, and every dirty dollop was crowned with bright pink lavy paper. It might me on those corals that you see in southern oceans. I wasn't walking through my park, I was going through their motions. I headed down to tell them off, but before I could even speak,
They chased me off my ain grun with a height of bloody chick. They telled me that in Scotland they had freedom for to roam. And here I'm paraphrasing when they telled me to go home. The chief maisteen amongst them, an o'er-a-looking chiel, tried to tell me a' the richts o' it, as if I were daft or feel. He laughed at me and got me a beer frae out of one of their hampers, while I just stood there scunnered at the wise o' clatty campers. That night I lay there raging. I never slept a wink. I could hear them till the wee sma' hours teeming o' that drink. But by the time the sun was up, I'd reckoned every factor and girded on my biler suit and went and got my tractor. It was a special kind of wake-up call, for I was in no hurry as I drove past slow in second gear with a tanker load of slurry. The flow rate was high to maximum. I'd set it in the barn as I carefully sprayed their campsite with 8 tons of bright green sharn. I doubt it was the breakfast for which they had been hoping, and it's safe to bet they might regret leaving car windows open. One peer loon was sleeping on the grass. He must have been wrecked foo, but now he woke up cowking with coffee sharn inside his moo. I'm nae saying it was the right thing to do, but faith, it was a glorious sight as the three wee tents were battered flat with a tidal wave of shite. But that morning they learned a lesson. A chuchter won't be scorned, and the welcome that awaits them here. Clatty campers, you've been warned.
Obviously, I'm not suggesting that as a national policy.
No. But it's an interesting thing. I was speaking to a ranger down in Loch Lomond, and he said they came across somebody with a lawnmower who'd gone into his field and mowed it flat so that they could camp in their tents. It just, there's a whole new world out there that hopefully some of the things we've addressed today might point those in charge to consider actions that might control it.
So that's what we came up with in the live programme, but if you're listening to this wherever you are in the world and you have similar sets of circumstances or you've got different solutions, because that's obviously really what we're after, Ewan, isn't it? It's solutions rather than repetition of the same problems.
Well, we kind of considered ourselves in a wee bubble of isolation here, but listening to the chap in New Zealand and our experiences in Yosemite would suggest that many, many, many countries throughout the world have already addressed this, and we'd really welcome your input as to how they do it. Is it a tax? Is it a ranger service? Do the police have more powers? There must be solutions out there. And, yeah, we'll pass them on to those in power.
The relevant authorities, indeed. You can contact us at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. We'll be very keen to hear your input, you know, from wherever you are around the world. If you have the time, if you could rate our podcast at the same time or possibly even like us, that's nothing to do with our egos. But apparently, I'm not sure how the system works, apparently it means that more people might actually find our podcast, and the more the merrier as far as we're concerned. From all of the team here at BBC Aberdeen, thanks for listening.